and Labor Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform.
And we will concurrently open the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor. Today is Monday, September 29th, and we are prepared at this juncture to receive some pre-session filed committee bills from our Healthcare Reform Subcommittee.
Okay, well, thank you for coming today. We have several items of an informational nature: update on House Bill 2002, report on the Health Fund Board, and healthcare workforce report, and then a work session on two legislative council drafts. We have been tracking House Bill 2002 for actually the almost the full length of the summer, and have had concerns about the rate increases. I suspect that I'm not the only member of this legislature that has heard from constituents and from brokers with respect to the effects, apparent effects, but yet to really understand what are the drivers totally. The changes of expanding the small group employer pool, and we have had in my district we have had rate increases as high as 62%, which for small employers is almost devastating. And so we've been trying to understand what's happening and track this the history of this bill and its impact in the market. So with that, we invite Scott Kicker, the administrator of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Insurance Division, to bring us up to date with respect to what data you have accumulated and where you think this is going and what some of the causes of these increases are.
Jim Morris, Chair Westland. Members of the committee, good morning. My name, for the record, is Scott Kipper. I am the Insurance Division Administrator in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And as you mentioned, Senator Morris, I'm here today to discuss House Bill 2002 and its implementation and effects. House Bill 2002 was designed and implemented to make the small employer health insurance market more stable in the long term. House Bill 2002 changed the way small employer group health insurance is regulated. The bill requires insurers to pool or combine groups comprised of small employers, those with 2 to 25 employees, and groups comprised of larger employers, that is, those employers with 26 to 50 employees, into one market. As you mentioned, we have heard anecdotally of those 30 to 40, even 60% rate increases in this marketplace. And there are those who have attributed those to the effects of House Bill 2002. While there are clearly some who have seen some of such rate increases and others who have seen decreases, I think it is important for us all to consider the impacts of House Bill 2002 in the overall context of health insurance rates. Health insurance rates for small employers are going up an average of 11% this year. There's a chart near the back of this testimony that is isolated the effects and the impacts of House Bill 2002. Some employers are continuing to see rate changes more or less than the average of 11% due to the implementation of House Bill 2002. Some businesses, particularly those who had rates relatively low, have seen sizable increases as part of this transition. On the other hand, there are businesses who have benefited from House Bill 2002 and either received rate decreases of less than the average increase, that is, less than 11%, or received rate decreases and do not or may not even recognize the fact that they have benefited from the passage of HB 2002. There are approximately 28,800 small employer groups in Oregon that provide coverage for roughly 265,000 Oregonians. Of this pool, approximately 180,000 people, or 68%, are in the previous small employer marketplace, that is, in those 2 to 25 employee groups. The balance, 32%, or roughly 85,000 Oregonians, make up the 26 to 50 employee group. Prior to House Bill 2002, these two segments of the now small employer marketplace were regulated differently. The combination of these two markets under HB 2002 have implemented major changes, including the establishment of a 3-to-1 rate band. Let me explain a little bit about what that rate band means. Prior to the passage of House Bill 2002, the 2-to-25 marketplace had a rate band limitation of 2.5-to-1, while that 26-to-50 marketplace had no such rate band limitation. In other words, the least expensive rate, or the most expensive rate, could be no more than 2.5 times the least expensive rate. In other words, we were in a position much like this. The new rate band created by House Bill 2002 allows for a slightly broader range of rates for employers with 2 to 25 employees and restricts the range of rates of 26 to 50 employees. Again, which prior to the passage of the bill did not have a statutory rate band limitation, but the marketplace has shown that this was an approximate 6-to-1 rate band. So what we've done with the 26 to 50 groups is gone from a rate band difference between here and compressed those rates to 3-to-1. For this reason, these prices could vary, and the larger of the two marketplaces, the 26 to 50, rates could vary significantly due to factors such as increased claims or underwriting discretion. In the long run, HB 2002's cap on claims experience use increases, claims experience increases, and its removal of underwriting discretion should provide more stable rates. There's a chart on page 4 that illustrates the differences. And I can walk you through that very briefly. This assumes an average rate of $100, and again, that's just for illustrative purposes. Under the current rating structure, that is the 3-to-1 rating structure, the lowest rate now would be $50, and the highest rate would be $150, or three times the lowest rate. Prior to the passage of 2002, in the 2-to-25 marketplace, the 2.5-to-1 rate band restriction created, for illustrative purposes, from $57 up to a high of $143. And because there was no rate restriction or rate band on the 26 to 50 groups, we used in illustrative purposes of roughly 6-to-1. That showed those rates could swing anywhere from $29 on up to $174. As the table indicates, the trending of prices towards the middle tends to stabilize this market by eliminating price extremes, that is, the highest and lowest, or reducing the highest rate and increasing the lowest rate. Under the example in the table, 2 to 25 employees could see a 12% or $7 reduction in the lowest available rates, and a 5% increase in the highest rates allowed, that is, moving from $143 to $150. The impact is most seen in the 26 to 50 employee group, where you would see a 72% increase in the lowest rates charged, that is, moving from $29 to the new $50 rate, and at least a 14% decrease in the highest rates charged, that is, moving from $174 to $150. And it was likely that many of those who have voiced concerns about large percentage rate increases were likely at the extreme low end of the 26 to 50 rate band. Another significant change implemented by HB 2002 is the introduction of a set of specific rating factors from which insurers can choose to set rates within that 3-to-1 rate band. These factors include age of all covered lives, participation in wellness programs, employer contributions or employer contribution levels, customer loyalty, tobacco use, and expected claims, which is limited to the 5% utilization. The 26 to 50 market was not limited to any set of specific rating factors. In the absence of rating factor restrictions in this market, for example, insurers could and did charge employer groups, in this case comprised mostly of young women, significantly higher rates than groups comprised of mostly young men. And again, this would be that the utilization of that natural 6-to-1 rate band feature. The introduction of specific rating factors and a 3-to-1 rate band has ended this practice. To minimize market disruptions caused by the merging of these two employer groups, HB 2002 allows insurers to phase in the pooling of the two groups and the rate bands over a 3-year period beginning April 1 of this year. Because most insurers have chosen to implement the change over the 3-year period rather than all at once, we may not know the full impact of HB 2002 until the year 2011. The insurance division understands that some small employers have recently seen significant increases in premiums. We hear from those employers just as you do, as they are your constituents. Questions have been raised whether these increases are attributable to HB 2002. When we testified before these committees in June, we provided 4 examples of real employer rate increases and decreases. We determined that factors unrelated to House Bill 2002, including health trend or health costs and trend, and the general aging of the population, accounted for the majority of rate increases. These examples have been provided again as an attachment for your convenience and understanding. To provide a historical context of the impact of HB 2002, the division examined rate changes over the last 6 years and shows that, if, for example, in the year 2003, the average rate increase was 17.1%. Again, I want to clarify, this is, we did combine the then small employer groups of 2 to 25, as well as the best information we could gather on the 26 to 50 groups. So this is a composite of those two groups. As you can see by the table, the small group market has experienced double-digit rate increases for each of the last 6 years. Although we only have data for the first 2 quarters of 2008, the increase this year that we've projected, that is 11.1%, appears to be in line with the trend of the last 2 years. To better assess the impact of HB 2002, the division has collected a random sample of data from the state's 8 largest domestic health insurers. Those 8 carriers control approximately 92% of the Oregon health insurance market. From the insurer's complete list of employer groups, we selected a random sample of 554 groups, 381 of which were the 2 to 25 employer groups, and that group included 2,944 insured lives, and 173 26 to 50 employer groups, comprised of 6,330 lives. Because the HB 2002 rate bands and rating factors only took effect on April 1 of this year, the sample data we collected is limited to 1/4's worth. The data collected by the division suggests that when you isolate the impact of HB 2002, that those rates changes and the effect of 2002 are negligible. The overall small employer group market saw rates increase by an average of 11.1% per member. Again, we feel that these factors are mostly unrelated to House Bill 2002, such as the increase in medical trend and the aging of the population. Medical trend tracks the cost, of course, of the use and utilization of medical care. And now Oregonians, as well as everybody across the country, are using medical services with greater frequency, and increase in the cost of medical care are far outstripping general inflation.
some conclusions. A substantial portion of these increases are attributable to trend and population aging, that is, factors unrelated to House Bill 2002. Another factor contributing to these increases is House Bill 2002's requirement that insurers choose from a limited set of specific rating factors, which include or exclude factors such as underwriting discretion and the use of gender. Prior to House Bill 2002, insurers in the 26 to 50 marketplace couldn't use these rating factors. Again, underwriting discretion allowed insurers to charge low rates to some employers, typically to those groups that they deemed to be a good underwriting risk and therefore profitable, in order to keep their business. To the extent that rating factors like these kept some rates lower, the abrupt cessation of their use likely significantly contributed to rate increases. Because insurers are allowed to implement the pooling and rate band requirements of House Bill 2002 over a three-year period, we will not know the full impact of the legislation until 2011. Employers that were receiving the lowest rates prior to HB 2002, because their rates were in that 6-to-1 rate band or in the 26 to 50 marketplace, might see additional increases as insurers continue to shrink the rate bands over that three-year phase-in period to get to the required 3-to-1 ratio. These employers, however, have already seen the greatest increases as a result of the rate band phase-in, because going forward, only small rate band decreases are necessary to get to a 3-to-1 ratio. It is important to remember that HB 2002's required rate bands and rating factors only took effect in April of this year, limiting us to the utilization of one quarter's worth of data. There are some who have raised concern that the passage of this bill would cause a drop in participation in the small employer market. Preliminary data, however, suggests differently. The two markets experienced a combined 2.9% decline in insured lives between the first quarter of 2007 and the first quarter of 2008. After this bill was implemented, however, the small group market has added 329 lives. While you can't say for sure that this bill directly halted the decline in the market, early data shows that the bill has not caused further retraction of the market, as some might have feared. Though it is difficult to predict what will happen going forward, the data we have gathered suggests that HB 2002 will push rates toward the middle, eliminating the extreme lows and the extreme highs, therefore providing greater stability in the small employer group marketplace. However, it is important to note that rates overall in Oregon will likely to follow the national trend and to continue increase significantly by double digits as the population ages, as utilization of health care services increase, and as the cost of medical care significantly outstrips the general rate of inflation. Adding to the difficulty in predicting what these rates will do in the future is the fact that insurers may choose to accelerate the phase-in of the rate bands and the pooling groups, or they may choose to continue the phase-in gradually as allowed by the bill. The multiple ways insurers price their products and conduct business will also continue to impact rates in a variety of ways. With that, Chair Morse, Chair Westman, I conclude my prepared remarks and be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Are you aware of a letter that we received from Kaiser Permanente?
Yes, sir.
You have seen that letter. Could you offer some thoughts on why their rates of increase for both groups, 2 to 25 and 26 to 50, have been, in the case of the 2 to 25 group in 2007, their rates increased were 7.2%, in 2008, 6.3%, and then we filed per House Bill 2002 were 6.3. In the 26 to 50 group, the rate increase in 2007 was 4.7%. In 2008, it was 3.5%. And then we filed per House Bill 2002, it increased to 8.9%, which these rates of increases appear to be substantially lower than the other providers in the marketplace.
If I might, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, offer some observations to this. Kaiser's business model is somewhat different than the rest of the industry. I believe they say in their letter that they are not a very aggressive or aggressively underwriting company, which means that they would not offer the low rates that we have seen where that are described in the low end of that 6-to-1 natural band, and therefore would not need to increase their rates as steeply as some of the other carriers have had to. That's my initial reaction to this situation.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your excellent presentation. It just even strikes me that this is incredibly complicated, incredibly delicate, and incredibly important that we get this right. This is one of those areas where, you know, minutia can dull the senses, but that does not abrogate our responsibility to, you know, address this fully and comprehensively and, most importantly, correctly. This is a big deal.
Thank you. Well, I would judge by your graph that I don't know where all those numbers fell, but it would appear that...
Which one are you on, Frank?
Just driving the start of the presentation. It would appear there are more covered lives with decreases than with increases. Is that correct?
If you take into account, and this chart does show the fact that we have removed medical trend, the effective medical trend, which we used, I believe, 12%. And we also removed the fact that populations and small employer populations move into the, by aging into the next age rate band. We removed those two items. And therefore, this is a little bit more truer representation of the effect of HB 2002. So even though there's a great many that show a 0% increase, for example, that in absolute numbers, you would have to add back in the effect of aging into the next age band and also add in the increase due to medical trend.
Do we know what the medical inflation rate is for the large group beyond 50?
I don't know. That's not an item that we track, but numbers probably would indicate it's comparable to the 12% that we used or that we get from carriers when they file the rates, that this is the medical trend that they're using.
Mm-hmm. Senator, do you have any thoughts?
I'm going to ask a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. I wonder if you have a sense of why, prior to House Bill 2002, there was such a significant difference in the way the 225 and the 2650 groups were treated. Because that struck me not only when we heard the testimony about it before, but in reviewing it now. There were obviously significant differences. And what might be the policy reasons for that?
There, Senator Bonamici, there's Chairman, there are a number of reasons why the bill was introduced and was passed. The 2-to-25 group historically has higher claims costs. They, for some reason, tend to have little riskier groups, and it's partly due to the fact that they were a guarantee issue marketplace. The expansion from 2 to 25 to now 2 to 50 was in part done to expand the pool of covered lives, which was anticipated that would stabilize those claims costs and therefore the health insurance rates that these small employers are charged.
Thank you.
Would you be able to provide the unadjusted and factored rates so that we can look at that data just on raw data?
Senator Morris, absolutely, we could do that.
That I think would be very helpful to at least see without the bias of those adjustments that you referred to. Okay. Any other comments or questions?
None at this juncture, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. While we're on this topic, I see some other folks from the industry that are here. Is there a desire to speak and shed some light on this issue?
Mr. Chair, we'd be glad to try to answer any questions the committee has if you desire that.
I don't have any.
John, I would like to hear just your perspective. I don't have a specific question. I don't know about Senator Bonamici. By the way, while they're coming forward, I would like to point out, Mr. Subcommittee Chair, that you are in an egregious error, and I, as the full committee chair, am in more egregious error for not welcoming our newest member, not only to the Senate, but to this committee.
Thank you.
Suzanne Bonamici. And she said, this is a fact, she said, she was walking in, she said, I'm just so excited to be here. I love this subject. I love this topic. And I'm just excited to see you across the floor when you're doing confirmations the other day. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
That's quite thoughtful. Very thoughtful. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and with me is Mike Becker from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I think to grasp globally this issue from our perspective, it is the fact that we were an aggressive underwriter of groups of 26 to 50. And as the letter from Kaiser Permanente points out, they were not. We were in the marketplace soliciting that business, giving the best rates we could to small employers. So House Bill 2002 affected each individual insurer is different. In the case of Regents, the biggest, by far, factor in the rating change was the underwriting discretion that was given. You could reward groups that were healthy and staying healthy and working on health. The passage of House Bill 2002 immediately wiped that out. So, by far, the greatest single reason for some groups to have a large increase is that they were on the lowest end, as the insurance administrator pointed out. They were getting the best rate the market would provide. And by a combination of taking away that discretion and applying the first part of the phase in of the rate bans, gave those people an extreme rate increase. So that is, I think, globally, from our perspective, the major factor in driving the rates for those that you've heard from. And you've already discussed the fact you wouldn't hear from those who benefited from the passage of this bill, because many of them wouldn't know it. That the fact that they got a small rate increase was due to the passage of this bill. So I would simply say that's how the implementation of House Bill 2002 affected regents.
Mr. Chair, if I'm Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, if I might just add one thing, that is how it impacted groups of 26 to 50. It had a more beneficial impact on groups of 2 to 25. And in fact, in that pool for regents, we saw some decreases, in some cases significant decreases, for the rates for those 2 to 25 groups. But again, it is important to keep in mind that the impact of this bill differs significantly from carrier to carrier, depending on how that carrier used rating factors and underwriting discretion in the 26 to 50 market, and how it pooled those groups above 25. Again, it varied widely.
So what I'm hearing you say is that the most determining factor in House Bill 2002 was the change in the rate plan. Is that what I'm hearing? Which those groups that employers that had favorable history by virtue of whatever it may be, demographics or their the way that they managed health care, are now subsidizing those that had higher costs. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, I asked a very similar question to our actuaries on Friday, and they came back to the loss of underwriting discretion in groups of 26 and above as the most significant factor, and they characterized the narrower rate bands as the second most impacting factor that was driving those rates for the groups in the new combined pool. And again, that is four regions.
Mr. Chairman, John Powell again, and the reason for that is the immediate effect of the passage of House Bill 2002 was the elimination of underwriting discretion. The rate band can be phased in over 3 years for the change in the rate band effect. And remember, the groups of 2 to 26 were already under a rate band and actually got rate band relief under the passage of this bill. It slightly expanded to 3 to 1. The rate band that was used. So that's why those groups came out more favorable. They already were under rate band. They got slight increased utilization of a wider rate band. Whereas over time, the effect of the rate bands on the 26 to 50 will have the effect that you pointed out. And that is younger, healthier groups will pay a higher premium, and older, less healthy groups will pay a lower premium over time.
Underscored by, you know, impact, 2002 impacted individual companies by, you know, either how aggressively or not they underwrote certain groups. Either not so much, not so much an impact. I don't know what Pacific Source does or Likewise, you know, their business model on that. But obviously, you aggressively underwrite. So,
sure, that's correct, and we're eagerly trying to participate in that marketplace as were some other carriers in this competitive market.
Hey, Senator Bonamici.
I'm fine, thank you.
You're fine, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for being here, guys.
is there anyone else in the audience that would like to reflect on House Bill 2002? Mr. Barber, do you have any thoughts or do you care to comment?
I'll just
okay. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2002, and I guess do this, don't we?
No.
Okay. It was just for informational to begin with. Okay. So move on to the Oregon Health Fund Board report. Barney, if you could join us, please. And Dr. Smith.
Good morning, Chair Morris, Chair Westland, members of the subcommittee and committee. I think this is a unique opportunity. I've never testified before two committees sitting at once. So, I have a handout that I believe has been made available to all of you and to the public. For the record, my name is Barney Spade. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Fund Board. And the board on September 3rd released a draft report to the public. And since September 3rd, we've had 10 community meetings across Oregon, Portland, Hillsborough, Gresham, Bend, Medford, Eugene, Salem, LeGrand, Newport, and Corvallis. And we estimate that approximately 1,000 people attended all of those meetings in total. In addition, we've received approximately 1,100 comments from Oregonians, either at the meetings themselves, through email, through written correspondence, etc. I don't know exactly what you'd like me to do this morning. I can walk through very briefly the components of the plan and then try to answer questions that you might have, if that's how you'd like to proceed.
I think you referenced a handout, and I'm...
Mr. Chair, it's in the member packet, so it looks like it is. If not, I can get you a
under
packet.
That sheet of paper, I'm guessing. No, the other sheet of paper.
No.
You can have it. Subcommittee chair, you got to shut them all.
We're going to take care of them.
Yeah.
Well, I have seen your, okay. And I just didn't bring it this morning, but okay. I have seen it. I have read it. And I think probably it would not be helpful to go through all 70 pages of the report today.
Or if all 45 pages of my slide deck. but I can summarize in broad themes.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
And I think we have some maybe some reflections and comments that we would like to make.
In addition to those accurate comments, if you could somehow summarize and maybe categorize some of the distinctions between different groups, different locations in the response in the public meetings to the proposal. This is what we said. This is what they said back.
Okay. Also joining me is Dr. Janine Smith, the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and Dr. Smith and her staff have been absolutely essential to carrying out the work of the board and its committees over the last 11 months. Let me just start with Senate Bill 329, as you know, laid out 12 goals that the board should work toward in its charter. The legislature chartered the board to develop a comprehensive plan to reform Oregon health care and to address the 12 goals listed in the legislation. Those 12 goals have really been synthesized by the board into four, and they're characterized on slide two of containing the annual increases of health care costs, expanding coverage to Oregon's uninsured citizens, continuously improving quality, safety, efficiency, and patient satisfaction in Oregon's healthcare systems, and to improve the health of all Oregonians, particularly with an emphasis on public health. The report, as Chair Morris indicated, is about 78 pages long, the draft report. And on slide three, we tried to, in a pictorial sense, summarized the report into 8 essential building blocks for building a healthy Oregon. And I'll spend a minute or two on each of these. Let me start with setting high standards and measuring and reporting and stimulating system innovation and improvement. Much of the report focuses on what the board believes is our foundational policy initiatives to transform the delivery system. You've heard from previous testimony on 2002 that medical trend is somewhere between 11% and 13%. Talk to different carriers. And it has been, while it may be moderating in some cases, it has been in the low double digits for several years. And there is a real concern about, I think on everybody's part, about the sustainability of the current system. So the board looking at bending the cost curve is really a systemic change needs to be undertaken. And the thrusts really come about in 2 major areas. And they're not profound to Oregon. Other states are doing undertaking these same kind of measures, and in some cases have already undertaken them. One is to have better information and more comprehensive information available to you as policymakers and to the public relative to how the healthcare system performs. That is, setting standards, measuring, and reporting. And with that measuring and reporting, they have a greater degree of transparency of that information in the marketplace. One of the criticisms of American healthcare from a market perspective is, in fact, the lack of transparency and information in costs, in utilization, in quality, in safety. There's a lot of debate now about whether markets work or don't work. And I'm not an economist, but information for consumers and others is a essential ingredient. And so we spend a lot of time in this draft report of laying out some suggestions to improve the availability of data, its analysis, and also to make that available to the consumer, to providers, to purchasers, and to insurers. Just to summarize, there's a uniform healthcare data collection program, which would be an all payer claims database. We borrowed from Minnesota legislation that they passed this year on reporting the percentage increases in contract rates that insurers have with providers. This is an effort to have a clear line of sight between what a price increase is, let's say for a hospital in a given community, and the resulting impact of that price change on subsequent impact on insured premiums. We also have a couple of suggestions relating to better monitoring of the what I call the health of the insured market, of understanding is particularly the small group or the 2 to 50 group or the individual market, is it contracting or expanding in particular geographic regions? And then lastly, there's the delivery committee, and there's been a lot of discussion about health facility capital expenditures and the appropriateness or the lack of appropriateness of certificate of need. This recommendation is basically a recommendation for much greater public reporting and requiring that above some threshold amount of a capital expenditure, which the legislature would set, that an entity would have to hold some public hearings and basically go to the public that pays that bill, particularly the business community, with the carriers, agents and brokers, and other members of the public, to explain the impact of a proposed capital expenditure on subsequent rates.
In the state of Oregon, you will talk about all the payers. We're the biggest purchaser of health care in the state, so let's not forget the guy who writes the biggest check.
Barney, you referenced something that to the effect that the legislature would set with respect to these capital expenditures. Could you?
Well, what's proposed in the draft is that there would be a statutory requirement that above a certain threshold, and I'm just going to pick one, a capital expenditure of more than $25 or $50 million would require an agency. It could be policy and research. It could be the facilities licensing division of the health division would have some public reporting requirements where there'd be a hearing. Public meeting in the community where the facility would explain the proposed capital expenditure and answer some questions. For example, what is the impact of the capital expenditure on your pricing, your pro forma pricing over a 3 to 5 year period? So that's what I meant by the purpose is not to have every capital expenditure reviewed this way, but those that are of significance, particularly rebuilding a facility or a major expansion of tens of millions of dollars.
Is there an expectation that there would be a control and a permit issued?
From the way the draft is written, Mr. Chair, the control would be public comment. That it's basically an opportunity, and I guess the metaphor that I would use, that we've heard through the committee work and through the work of the board, is that hospitals in particular are very much, they're too big and too important to fail in communities. They're like a fire district or a school system. But we've also heard that in some communities, with all due respect to the governing boards of these facilities and their management, is that the community doesn't necessarily feel, as the ratepayer ultimately, that they know in advance what's this proposed capital expenditure going to mean to the rates I pay in subsequent years. And so this is an effort at least to have some transparency and community dialogue around that. So I think if there's pressure there, it's the pressure of public opinion. And we know in some cases and in some communities there's great debate that already happens. In other communities, it doesn't happen. This would somewhat set a standard of community engagement in these kinds of investments. The draft plan also proposes to set standards in clinical quality measures, specifically to have a uniform set of quality measures that would be applicable throughout Oregon, across all carriers, and applicable to all providers, so that everybody knows the quality yardsticks that we would be using and measuring from. A lot of emphasis on more work collaboratively on evidence-based guidelines. The Health Services Commission has worked on these over the years. There's an expression by some that if we had more uniform and collaborative evidence-based guidelines that all carriers could use, that were developed in the public domain and could be used by carriers, there would be a more effective utilization management standard across multiple carriers. Similarly, with what's called comparative effectiveness standards, in the old world, 20 years ago, it was called medical technology assessment. We need a process to more effectively bring what I call the best of medicine together in a disciplined way to look at emerging technologies and understand exactly how they should be used clinically based on the information that's available. We lay out a number of choices in this. These can be voluntary. They could be required to be adopted. In both cases, with evidence-based guidelines and comparative effectiveness, we've looked at states like Minnesota and other states who have done a lot of this, particularly with collaboration across the carriers, in engaging the medical community to agree on the best standards that are available. There's a proposal on end-of-life care. I think that we've seen information that Oregon does an excellent job compared to other states relative if we're using the benchmark of the expenditure, Medicare expenditures in the last 2 years of life. We are 48 to 49 in the country as far as being effectively using resources at the end of life. But we are suggesting, based on testimony from the Center for Ethics at OHSU, that there be a registry created, statewide registry, for a form that's called PULSE. The acronym is PULSE. It stands for Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. This is a legal document that has the force of law, if you will, for providers, that it expresses the patient's wishes relative to treatment, particularly by first responders. And then lastly, in the area of setting standards, there is already a voluntary effort going on that involves provider organizations and Oregon's main dominant carriers of looking at administrative simplification. We have had for 10 years standards nationally through HIPAA, but there's also great variation in lower levels of administration, and there's an attempt to try to get more standardization and more streamlining. This has a particular impact on providers, and that there could be a more standardized way deeper than a claims form, that there could be some savings in administrative simplification. We're proposing that at least the legislatures, that perhaps the board applauds that voluntary effort, but is really asking the question, does that need to be more than voluntary? Should the insurance division play a more active role in looking at administrative simplification? In stimulating system innovation and improvement, this is where the board really believes that over the next 5 to 10 years, Oregon should play a leadership role in developing or transforming Oregon's delivery system. And it starts from a perspective that we have a very good delivery system built on an acute care model, but that a major portion of healthcare expenses every year, something like 60% plus, are related to chronic conditions. And that a system built with stronger primary care and chronic care management can in fact be both cost containing, quality improving, and quality of life for the patient. So we look at areas of new models of care. There's a series of recommendations around the development of what we're calling in Oregon the integrated health home. In other communities, it's called the primary care model. Of developing these integrated health homes, and that the state should be a major instigator and innovator in purchasing, particularly initially through the Oregon Health Plan, in the development of integrated health homes. There's recommendations on how the Department of Human Services should be much more aggressive in the integration of behavioral health with physical health. And there's some very interesting models that some communities are already doing in partnerships between the local mental health authority, fully capitated health plans, and the county public health, of developing new ways of organizing care on the ground for closer integration, starting with coordination and collaboration, but ultimately into integration. There are several recommendations on community-based innovation. The board and its committees have learned in the last 11 months about a lot of fascinating and interesting work that's being done in local communities. We name four that we're aware of. We've had testimony from the 100% Access Coalition in Lane County. There's a similar three-county coalition in the Bend area. one in the Medford and Grants Pass area, and one in Eastern Oregon, and that these community collaboratives are really bringing together public and private organizations to manage not only the Oregon Health Plan, but particularly better manage folks without insurance, and to, again, push on this issue of coordination, collaboration, and integration. We make some recommendations on the community safety net. The safety net, community clinics, federally qualified health centers, and other such clinics are integral to most communities, not only in the delivery of health care to Oregon Health Plan, but to members of the public that don't have health insurance. There's a strong set of recommendations in public health, particularly emphasizing a continuation of Oregon's commitment to tobacco cessation programs, but also developing new community-based initiatives around obesity, nutrition, and activity levels. And these community-centered programs are envisioned to be collaborative with schools, the workforce, public-private organizations at the community level. We have a crisis in juvenile diabetes. We will continue to have a crisis over the next 10 or 15 years, and I think the board is suggesting that we need to attack the issue of obesity, particularly childhood and young adult obesity, as we did with tobacco cessation 20 years ago. Otherwise, we're going to have huge issues of chronic disease in this cohort in the future years. And we're already seeing it now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Barney, factoid from left field, but someplace in all these meetings, I think it was Dr. Connell, but he indicated that 62% of the increase, not of the cost, but of the increase in health care cost was due to obesity. Is that a fair, pretty close? Am I imagining something?
Chair Morrison, Chair Westland, this is Janine Smith, Office of Health Policy. I believe in the early testimony, I think actually in your interim committee, he presented a slide where the impact was how chronic disease was really infecting the cost of care and the increased rise, and of which then all those chronic diseases were related back to obesity or correlated closely with obesity.
Was that percentage?
It was around 60%, right, was the slide.
Well, I think it includes diabetes, asthma, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease. I'm trying to think of the top five. All of those chronic conditions, and with many patients or individuals, there are comorbidities. You have multiples of these, and weight, nutrition, and activity.
So
are all
chronic,
are contributing factors.
Chronic disease, not necessarily, but likely attributable.
Because those diseases are aggravated by the obesity.
Right. Okay. The board is also suggesting that the tobacco tax be increased, and that perhaps the legislature consider increasing tax on alcoholic beverages. Unlike Measure 50, the board, however, thinks that those taxes ought to, if they were to be increased, they should be dedicated explicitly to public health programs. Another part of the system innovation relates to health information technology. The board did not have a committee of its own that looked at HIT. The governor, a few months ago, created an advisory committee to his office, the Health Information Infrastructure Advisory Committee. And the recommendations that the draft report include are recommendations from that committee, euphemistically known as HIAC, another acronym in the healthcare jargon. But really, we're focusing on how do we increase the pace of the adoption of electronic medical records. Oregon is a leading state compared to other states as far as the adoption of EMRs, particularly in our hospital community and larger practices. There's some recommendations of how do we help practitioners in small offices, particularly offices located in rural and frontier areas. The need to encourage the use of clinical support tools inside electronic medical records, to have a goal of having a statewide information exchange by 2012. And this really addresses the issue of if we had all of the providers in the Oregon wired, the term I use, using electronic information systems, if they're not interoperable and can't communicate, then we haven't really gained what we need, which is the movement of information between providers and among providers. And then lastly, there's some recommendations relating to privacy and security. So when we look at the standards and the stimulating innovation, if you think of these strategically, I like to think of them as a commitment, a policy commitment, to improving value-based purchasing and the delivery of value-based care, of having more information available to understand for the consumer, are we getting value? For provider organizations, how does our performance match up with other providers in Oregon, providers in other states, national or international benchmarks? There are a number of suggestions under another building block, which is unifying purchasing power. As Senator Wesselin indicated, the state is a major purchaser of health care, I think second only to Medicare. And that's through both the Oregon Health Plan, which purchases on behalf of over 400,000 Oregonians in poverty, and then as an employer through the Public Employees Benefit Board, and also now the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. And there's some recommendations in having a much more unified strategic approach to purchasing as far as contracting standards, looking at areas like quality measurement, innovation in areas, for example, of patient decision-making aids and things like that. And ultimately, a vision that potentially the state and local municipalities could, in fact, cooperatively purchase together in a particular region. There are three recommendations in this area of unifying purchasing power that you ask kind of what was the response in the community. One is the proposal to create a health insurance exchange to unify the individual market even before we get to the second stage of expansion that's referenced. And it's the board's concern about the recent rate increases in the individual market. And this concept has received a lot of discussion from the Agent Boker community and others about will it work, and will it actually achieve what the board would like to see it achieve, and we've heard extensive testimony written and verbal on that. And then there are two other areas. While most of this work of the board is in system transformation, there are two that are of a regulatory orientation. I think the draft report indicates that the legislature may want to consider deeper oversight and potential regulation of insurers' administrative expenses, and particularly to understand are they rising faster than the CPI or more with the medical CPI, and if they are, why? And then the concern about medical trend and the year-over-year increases of should Oregon consider having some sort of price ceiling on provider prices that they can raise, they can rise only more than some specified amount? Those two regulatory approaches in our community meetings and written communication are controversial. The Oregon does not have a strong history of regulation compared to states like New York or those on the East Coast. And the board will be taking these comments under advisement. Another area that you'll hear from me lately, that's in the report that you'll hear later from your next panel, is a healthcare workforce. And I know that the subcommittee, the interim subcommittee, has focused on this, and the board sees this as an essential building block for the next decade or two. Its recommendations, I think, square with what I have read or heard your interest in as a subcommittee, of having reliable data to understand what the current healthcare workforce characteristics are. We know that the demographics of the healthcare workforce are similar to the demographics of the population. We have a substantial number of physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, nurses, clinical technicians, and others retiring. And there's concern about the pipeline in Oregon to replace that, of also creating an environment that Oregon can recruit and retain. I think the finding of the board in this area is that we need a strategy. Oregon needs a strategy on workforce development. We don't recommend what that strategy is, but we need to have the information, and we need to have somebody charged with working with all of the entities and organizations involved in this complex issue to one, help develop it, and then help execute it. As I indicated in testimony before the subcommittee several months ago, we had a health equities committee which looked at and advised the board specifically on how Oregon should address the disparities in health that occur because of race, ethnicity, geographic isolation, gender, and other factors. And so there are recommendations throughout the report that look at health equities, recommendations to address disparities, and then we've consolidated those into a chapter, if you will, by themselves, so that we can look at the issues of health disparities. We'll focus on outreach and education into communities of color, translation services within the Oregon Health Plan, and emphasis on training providers in culturally appropriate disease management. As the committee also knows, we have a federal laws committee that was called out specifically in 329 to look at where federal policy could inhibit Oregon from moving forward with a plan for reform. And we did have that committee, and its report is somewhat separate from the board's because it will be sent to the congressional delegation, but will also be included in the report to the legislature. I'll call out two areas that the Federal Laws Committee and the board feel very strongly that are federal policy areas. There are several recommendations, but the two I would mention. One is Medicare payment policy. And I think probably many of you are aware of that Medicare reimbursement to physicians and hospitals in Oregon is significantly... Are you all right, Senator? Okay. We have a doctor here. is significantly lower than other parts of the country. We're not unique in this. Several states are suffering from the same problem, but it's become very clear that in many parts of Oregon, particularly physicians, are limiting their practice to what I would call traditional Medicare recipients. The irony is that we have a very strong penetration of Medicare HMOs and PPOs, the highest penetration in the nation. But we believe that the congressional delegation, working with delegations from other states, even a joint resolution from this legislature, important to raise this issue that there can't be a one-size-fits-all approach to particularly controlling Medicare in or a state like Oregon, where the reimbursement levels are so low compared to other states. The other is to reiterate on the healthcare workforce. Federal policy has a significant impact on not only Oregon, but the national healthcare workforce, and how they reimburse training programs. There are limits, there are caps now on residency programs that limit the number of residency programs in current institutions. Ironically, the federal policy allows new residency programs to be developed, and there's a recommendation to support OHSU's proposal for an ORMED program, where there would be three or four hospitals that would be working with OHSU on residency programs. Additionally, federal policy is important in the whole issue of tuition assistance for those wanting to go into the healthcare field. Lastly, wrap up, the report recommends that the legislature create an entity that we're calling the Oregon Health Authority. As you all know, Senate Bill 329 created the Oregon Health Fund Board. The Senate Bill 329, without further legislative action, sunsets on January 2nd, 2010. And the board in 329 was really given one job: create a plan. The only thing that 329 tells the board to do is go create a plan, give it back to us. The board will do that. We'll deliver a plan. And the board believes that the board ought to go away, and that the Oregon Health Policy Commission ought to go away, and that there ought to be a entity created for healthcare, like we have for K-12 with the Board of Education, that we have in higher education with the Board of Higher Education, unlike Oregon has with the Transportation Commission, that there be an entity, a citizen board, that is charged with some accountability for looking at the broad system performance in cost, in quality, in access, in safety, and patient satisfaction, and that this authority would help drive the changes that are suggested in the rest of the report. In fact, many board members think that while we put the health authority at the bottom, it's probably one of the most strategic issues for the 2009 legislature to consider. I did leave the top building block off. Let me go back to bringing everybody under the tent. As you all know, the several committees of the board looked very hard at a Massachusetts-style model of requiring insurance for all citizens, providing subsidies for low and moderate income folks, a financing tool for that may be. We are much more informed about how Oregon could in fact do that, but the board's position from a principle that it adopted early on was that they want their recommendations to be sustainable. And so a move toward to a Massachusetts or a model that, for example, that California considered, they really see that this needs to be done in a staged manner. And it needs to be staged primarily because if year-over-year cost increases are in the 9%, 10%, 11% range or even higher, if there was an agreed-upon financing mechanism for a universal coverage, that revenue stream will probably not grow at the same rate that the expense costs are rising, and therefore it would be unsustainable. So what they are suggesting is that stage one of a bringing everyone under the tent would be the adoption of a expansion for the Oregon Health Plan for all kids, similar to ballot measure 50, to save the Oregon Health Plan standard program, which now has about 24,000 folks in it, and actually expand it. The tough issue in this expansion of this proposal for the board and for everybody else, quite candidly, is a financing plan. They're suggesting to at least look at the existing provider taxes, which have to be changed, and see is there a way that we can use the provider tax to leverage federal funds to expand both those programs. If we were to do that, if there was a way to finance it, we estimate that we can reduce the number of uninsured by approximately close to 200,000, 175 to 200,000, which would reduce it, at the current level, would reduce it by about a third. We believe that the report suggests that if there were a health authority, that it look at further expansions in the 2011 to 2013 based upon how successful under cost containment is. Can we actually bend the cost curve, and to do further work on available funding approaches that would allow for those expansions in a premium assistance type of model. Mr. Chairs, as I said, the report has been out in draft form for comment. The board is meeting tomorrow for about 5 hours to receive formal comment as a full board, because the community meetings were basically one or two board members at each community meeting. We will then meet again in early October to receive as staff direction from the board as far as how they want to modify the draft report based upon public comment and their individual and collective reflection on that comment. And then we hope to, after the election day, have a final meeting of the board in early to mid-November to finalize the report and deliver it to the governor and legislative leadership in late November.
Thank you, Marty.
Janine, do you have any comments you'd like to
share? I'm just here for any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. All right. I do have some thoughts, and I'm sure the members of the committee do as well. First, a huge thank you, Barney and Janine, for the work that you have done, and the board and all of the committees. You didn't reference the numbers, I think the number of people, but a tremendous number of people.
Yeah, maybe I should get that on the record. We had seven committees when you include the Health Information Advisory Committee and two work groups. Over 100 volunteers worked from basically mid-October through May on these committees, and we had professional staff for each of the committees, and I think one of the things I'm proud about is that we had very diverse representation on these committees. We had across the range of perspectives on healthcare reform. A lot of hard work, really dedicated volunteers, dedicated staff. And then the board has the other aspect of process is that the board has done all of this in a very transparent way. We participated. The board was invited in the spring to visit 15 communities and hear what Oregonians' values were in healthcare reform. We've done the 10 community meetings. At almost every meeting of the committees and the board, we've received public testimony, it's been an interesting ride to get all. I didn't know whether we could get a report out in 11 months, but with warts, or it's not perfect. There's lots of difference of opinion. I'm very proud of the seven individuals who are really working hard at this. I think it reflects the best on kind of the citizen involvement in the best of the Oregon tradition.
Without question, it's a huge task, likely nearly impossible, given the complexity of the healthcare delivery system and all the special interests that come to bear within that system. But I'd like to offer you just a reflection as a member of the legislature. I sat down and I started reading the report, and I didn't stop until I got to the end, and I'll be very honest with you, the last very few pages, I was starting to fade a little bit, but I came away from that with some, I guess I would call them, for lack of a better word, disconnects in the way the report is structured and the content of the report. A reference is to aim high, and while you have many, many good ideas in the report, I didn't have that sense of aiming high, particularly as it relates to the area of cost containment, which is number one issue. A reference in the report to a sense of urgency, but yet I felt the report really focused on marginal changes around the borders and left the architecture of healthcare, our delivery system, intact. And I have a huge reservation as to whether we have the ability to contain costs within the architecture that we presently have. What I would hope for in cost containments are specific recommendations, specific strategies and tactics that would carry those out as to how can we contain costs. Because as we all know, there is a trajectory at which things begin to just literally fall apart. And how many years hence is that? It's not that far out, actually, to where things really begin to fail. The one thing that I thought was very absent in the report was the whole issue of utilization and physician behavior and tort reform, and those three things all tie together in a way that has a huge impact on cost. And I don't know where your discussions fell in the whole issue of tort reform, but the experience that I have had in healthcare governance and listening to physicians and physician decisions with respect to patient care is driven, there's a huge influence for fear of tort actions against them. So we have a system that essentially rewards those decisions. So my reflection is that I was hoping more in terms of specific cost containment measures, because I believe if you bore into those issues in depth, you begin looking at the structural, what I would call architectural changes that need to occur within the system. Price controls externally, in my judgment, are very, very flawed in terms of cost containment. But the concept of more of a global budgeting approach, which our interim committee focused on pretty extensively, really didn't surface much in the report. So those are some of my reflections. I was hoping for more specific strategies in terms of how will we control these costs. Senator Bonucci?
Can I make at least one comment back?
Yeah, sure.
Because I would like to talk about, I would like to acknowledge your comment on tort reform. The Senate Bill 329 did lay out a huge agenda for us to tackle. I could use the excuse time and resources, or I could use the excuse temerity. We basically didn't take on the tort reform issue as far as a solution. The report, one aspect of the report that we know that will be modified in the draft will be a section on the need to address tort reform, whether it be through an Oregon Health Authority, but that issue needs to be resolved. And even if we had taken it on, I don't think in the time available we could have, if you will, come up with a solution that all the stakeholders would agree to. But you are absolutely right, and Dr. Hoffman's pointed this out. We've heard it consistently from a number of quarters. Because the cost of defensive medicine is significant, and we're aware of that. The only other thing I would say, and probably this is one of the areas when we think about redrafting the report, is that in many of the areas that you're commenting on, Senator Morris, we're really suggesting that the first thing we need are a set of tools to be even able to address kind of the architectural changes. In the absence of statewide information in some of these areas, we simply don't know. We can't ascribe a global budget to a community. We can't look at the variation in utilization patterns. Let's just take one that we all hear about. Bend has 9 MRIs. Utilization in one entity, 600% increase in 1 year. This is anecdotal. These are the kind of things we hear about. We have no way in today's world. Carriers see it from their own perspective for their book of business in a community, but they don't see the full community. And I don't believe we're going to have fundamental architectural change until we have an information base that actually allows us to look at variation and to understand why it happens, that providers can have it. So these are tools, and that's the only defensive response I would make to your very appropriate constructive criticism.
Thank you. I might amplify just a little bit more. To me, the analogy would be a failing business. Now, we have wonderful delivery. We have, you know, as you say, the best technology. We have wonderful providers. But the system as a whole is failing. And the sense of urgency, I think, is much shorter than a multi-year, you know, six-year beyond horizon. It's much, much shorter than that. What I would hope for is what I would expect from a business case model, where you begin focusing on if righting this ship is where we need to go, and cost containment is the foundation for getting that ship back on its even keel, then specifically what are those things that we can do, and then structure the report so everything flows off that cost containment. You have some really good ideas that flow into that. And then with some attempt, and it may be at a later date, and certainly beyond 11 months we've given you to do it, is to quantify those, look at the risks, the assessments, for what those specific tactics might be. But I guess I was hoping for more in terms of this is the roadmap, there's some forks in the road, but specifically what we're going to do to get on top of this whole issue of cost. And so that's a member of one, reading your good work, but hoping for more in terms of making those hard choices, knowing that this is a very political body. We have all kinds of special interests and folks that don't want change. But change has to occur, and we need somebody pulling us forward. We may have things that are not politically attainable, functionally, that would work, but at least stretch us to that end in terms of what that strategies might be. So that's my reflection.
I appreciate that, Senator Morse. And I believe you are now a member of the Oregon Health Policy Commission.
We had a very robust discussion.
Yes. Yes.
Was it last Friday?
Last week.
Yeah, last week. So.
Go ahead.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to reiterate the thanks that Senator Morris gave for all the work that you've done and all the traveling around the state and getting input from the communities. I know it's been a tremendous amount of work, and I know it's appreciated. First, I want to say, as somebody who sits on the Tort Claims Task Force, I want to thank you for not rushing into that issue, because it is very complex, and we want to make sure that we have everything we need in terms of research before we address that issue. So thank you for not rushing into that, although I agree that it will be a discussion that we're having. My sense is that looking at all these suggestions, there's obviously going to be significant cost, and you talked about the tobacco tax and revisiting that and the provider tax, and of course, as we're facing these difficult economic times, we have challenges ahead on that. But what I would really like to see, and maybe it's difficult to quantify, but what I would like to see is some studies or some sense of what we get for our investment in terms of how much do we save by covering uninsured children, how much do we save by providing the preventive care that people need, so that we can convince our colleagues and our constituents that it's a good investment to spend those funds to increase those taxes so that we can make the investment. So I don't know if that's something that can be quantified, but it would be helpful, I think, to me, to be able to say, yes, it's an expense, but look what we get in the long term is these cost savings down the road. So any help that you can give us in getting that data, I think that would be very helpful.
Thank you for that. And in the final report, I think we'll have two additions that you don't see in the draft. One, the board has asked for what we call any of the infrastructure costs, for example, setting up an alternate claims database. How much is that going to cost? So we will, for each of the infrastructure approaches, we'll have estimates either based upon the experience of other states or the analysis that Janine and staff and others have done. In a number of the strategic issues, for example, around health information technology, some of the public health recommendations in the areas of the integrated health home, we will have information that for example, we know the return on, or the public health division can give us pretty good information on return on investment of tobacco cessation and programs like that. That can be a compelling argument that it's a wise investment. Similarly, there's in the area of this whole issue on primary care transformation or the integrated health home, we have data from not only this country but other countries that we can put together to show how that in fact can change the system. And I'll give you one example that just came out in the last week or so. The Geisinger Health System in Pennsylvania has used their primary care integrated health home model in their Medicare program. And in 1 year, I think it's between 2006 and 2007, they reduced hospital admissions by 20% and overall costs by 6% in 1 year. And it's basically what I call aggressive, robust primary care intervention in a population with comorbid chronic diseases. That's the structural change that we need to pay for. It. I mean, we get in healthcare what we pay for, and what we need to begin to do in payment reform is to begin to pay for a different kind of outcome so that the business model can change along that. But we can put the best of the estimates that are available so that can be a tool for you and your policy making.
Thank you very much.
In the Whatcom County pilot project a number of years ago,
yes,
showed the same results. In fact, so dramatic that the providers were Spanish.
Yep. Well, see, this is the difficult, I mean, this is the kind of, particularly at the community level, of when you begin to change and you move, you know, and you particularly in a governance role, is that if we have robust primary care and have preventable hospitalizations, that's going to have an impact on the hospital business model. How do we do that at a community level so that we move this transformation and it's a win-win as opposed to a win-lose? And the other part of this is clearly the workforce issue. We have a crisis in primary care. And to make some of these new models work, we're going to need to address that. But hopefully in these areas that are even perhaps much too visionary, we can have some appendices that indicate, you know, where the potential system payoff is. We have some pretty good data, for example, health information technology, about the long-term savings, both national data and research that's been done here in Oregon.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marty, I think you understated a little bit of the engagement and robustness of these public outreach meetings. I attended a few, and it was really exciting to see the level of genuine public engagement and concern in these meetings. And, you know, Barney and the staff did a great job of kind of corralling and shepherding and channeling into a productive work product these meetings. And those meetings are what, you know, belie the underlying fundamentals of this. Senator Morse alluded to the unsustainability of current practice. And as we see energy prices quadrupling, as we see credit drying up and a 700 pick your number bailout, I mean, there is less money to do fewer things. So those things we want to do, we have to do them better with less money. So no more urgent clarion call for 329 and its purpose could be sounded in what we have seen, totally separate and aside from, quote, healthcare issues. And the key to this, and you asked for tools, Barney, and what we need in the legislature, you know, is a very clear roadmap. And we want to give you those tools, but you've got to enumerate them. Can't be just here's the health authority. It's a little bit like Bush saying, give me $700 million, trust me, I'll fix it. We need specific tools. We need specific recommendations, of which there are many. And, you know, to reduce utilization, and as an overarching larger subset of that, you know, reduce costs. And we also need those in time, like out of tomorrow's meeting, so we can start to build the political coalitions. I mean, this just isn't an academic exercise. It isn't a, you know, a calculus problem. It's more difficult than that. I give you total credit for the, you know, difficulty of this. You know, what we do is not rational. It's not irrational. It's political. You know that better than I. So we need time to build these political coalitions going into the session. Just can't show up January 7th and say, here it is. We've got to have some momentum behind us. There are things I sound like I'm being pejorative. I'm not. You have done a Herculean task. You in particular, Janine and Hooper, but you know, Thorndike and Ader, Meow, Hoffman, Mundy, Eileen. Did I leave anybody off?
Tom Chamberlain.
Tom Chamberlain. Oh yeah, that guy. This is tough stuff. And what I feel like is, like, okay, this is a good start, but we need more specificity, specific recommendations, you know, kind of like what NASA developed when they were first trying to go to the moon, called the PERT chart, Performance Evaluation and Review Technique. Step A had to happen before step D could happen before you had to do Z. You know, I mean, this complicated Rubik's Cube that got to launch. And that's what I think we need to get into this session. But you guys have been out there, you've been warriors. I really appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
And I have one technical question. I say the state's the biggest purchaser. You say it's Medicare.
To be honest, I don't know.
I don't know.
I can tell you, at least in our payer mix in the Mid-Willamette Valley from the coast to the Cascades, 55% is Medicare, Medicaid. 45% is Medicare. 10% is Medicaid.
Right.
32% is commercial. And in that commercial falls state,
right.
County, city,
that's where I was
schools.
Going.
And the balance is uncompensated charity care.
And I'd be surprised that Medicare isn't the largest payer, but that the state of Oregon as Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan, and as an employer, put those two together, we would be the second largest payer.
So Medicare rules the roost. And that's the system that doesn't pay for
one of the things they're struggling with.
We've seen an erosion of the commercial payer decline from 36% to 32%. Now, is that a trend that will continue as costs increase and employers pull back and transfer the costs greater to employees that can't afford it? I had an opportunity to spend a couple hours with Jonathan later, and we had lunch, and he shared with me some data, and he's very passionate about this whole issue and the research that he's done, which would make a great part of your introduction to develop the sense of urgency, some of that data, because there is a line at which the projections cross, and it does fall at that point in terms of the cost of health care for a family versus family income, and the cost of health care then exceeds the family income, and obviously that model doesn't work. So Marty, thank you.
You're welcome.
Gene, for all the work you've done with literally an impossible task. I think our encouragement would be not to just aim high, aim higher.
We'll do it. We'll try to hit the target.
And like the Egyptians building the pyramids, build those ramps so we can lug those heavy stones up there.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak with respect to Senate Bill 329 and the Health Fund Board? Hearing none, we will move to the next item.
We'll stand at ease for just 2 minutes.
ASL Krasansky out.
Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform. The next item on our informational agenda is Healthcare Workforce in Oregon, and we invite Joe Iskrig, the Executive Director of the Healthcare Workforce Institute, to come forward and discuss these items. He wants to go through the discussion, then we'll close the informational hearing and move into a work session.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Joe Iskrig. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and we're following up on some work that we have been conducting over the year with the with 19 of the health licensing boards, the executive directors and the licensing managers of those boards, and some other stakeholders to develop a work plan to collect healthcare workforce, health professions workforce data via the licensing process. And Barry always tees it up very nicely about the need to address the workforce shortage issue in this state. That's not only in addition to providing additional coverage, but we have a growing population, an aging population, that we need to address the workforce to make sure that there is enough primary care providers and other providers there to care for the population. So we've looked at other ways in which this data is collected, either through surveys that are done infrequently or more general in nature. So we don't have really a good, accurate picture of what our healthcare workforce looks like. And so through discussion, the logical venue seemed to have come forward is the licensing process, where we can get 100% response rate for those renewing their license. And Oregon's had a successful model. Since 2001, the Oregon Board of Nursing and the Oregon Center for Nursing have collaborated together to look at workforce data collected as part of the renewal process for nurses and the six occupations under the Board of Nursing. And with that information, they've actually been able to make a very good, compelling case for the nursing workforce shortage and to increase educational capacity. In addition, other states are starting to look at using the health licensing process to be able to collect such workforce data as well. So following a request from the Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform from December 2007, we've convened the executive directors of the licensing boards, their licensing managers, workforce research experts and subject matter experts and other stakeholders to develop a work plan. And within that work plan, what has come forward, let me briefly just describe the components of that. To collect, routinely collect really good, accurate, uniform, consistent information through the health licensing renewal process. And we identified as the essential questions that would be included on either the initial application, which most of the information is included on the initial application, and then on the renewal application specific to that particular occupation. The group identified a phase-in data collection process targeting the key access and shortage occupations, and then the frequency and method of that data collection would be determined, either a paper format or an online format, is determined by the licensing board's renewal process and the frequency. And it's noted that several of the boards are actually bringing their application processes up online, so there are going to be some cost efficiencies there if we can add these questions at the same time. And then similar to the relationship between the Board of Nursing and the Oregon Center for Nursing, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute would work with these boards to be able to analyze the data and produce the reports using the aggregated data. And the issues that were identified in part of this process, number one is to address the essential questions needed for data collection to avoid the undue costs and any undue burden on the licensees. Protecting the confidentiality of the licensees was also important to the work group. We've had discussions on whether the questions should be voluntary or mandatory, and have concluded that they need to be mandatory in order to collect the accurate, uniform, consistent information. And with that, there were boards that requested some statutory authority to be able to support their effort to mandate those questions be completed. And then there were some costs identified in relation to that in terms of the executive directors following up with those licensees who don't complete the application, that there would be some costs with that, as well as the costs associated with reformatting some of the paper applications and programming the online questions, and then the staff time to input the data as well. The other issue that was identified is that there are some health practitioners that don't have to be licensed by a state board. That's a voluntary license. So to add questions to their particular license application wouldn't actually give us an accurate picture of that total workforce. And then finally, the executive directors themselves identified, beyond their regulatory scope and oversight scope, that there is indeed very valuable uses for this information collected through the licensing process. So with that, a legislative concept has been developed. that addresses many of these issues, legislative concept 1163, that addresses many of these issues. And this particular legislative concept did focus in on the Board of Dentistry, the Board of Nursing, Pharmacy, the Medical Board, the Occupational Therapy and Physical Therapy Licensing Boards as well. So I also brought with me on the panel today Dr. Lisa Dodson. She's a family practice physician, family medicine physician at OHSU and the director of the Area Health Education Center. She's been involved in these conversations, as well as conducted many, many studies on our health workforce in the state, and actually is quite the innovator of coming up with solutions to address our workforce needs in rural and underserved areas. And Patrick Bratz, who's the executive director of the Board of Dentistry.
Thank you. Thank you for all the work that you've done.
It's been an honor. Jill. Thank you.
It's been tremendous pulling such a divergent group of professionals together to have this legislative draft. I invite your testimony.
I think Patrick Bratz, Oregon Board of Dentistry, just comment and echo too. I want to thank Joe. She's done a tremendous job of working with all of us and trying to come up with a consensus. And I just briefly had a chance to look at the LC this morning, and I think it pretty much entails what we talked about and the things that we feel we need to have if we're going to make this be a successful workforce study. And especially from our standpoint, it's got to be mandatory so that we can make people give us the information that we think is vital to have to have you be able to make decisions on certain educational and funding, as well as, you know, we talked about some of the security and some of the emergency plans that might need to be put in place in the state, and without knowing where certain people are or where they're planning on being, we won't be able to do this. So I think the concept in its original or first draft looks very good.
I'm Lisa Dodson, the director of the Oregon AHEC program and a family physician and a member emeritus of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. One of the issues that I just wanted to bring to light was that most of the discussion has been largely around the initial licensure and subsequent licensure of health professionals, and I just wanted to remind the members that the educational side of that is not included, because our students are not licensed as they proceed through their training. In medicine, you first become licensed generally at temporary license as your first year of postgraduate medical training, and then eventually at completion of training. For our nursing students and other health profession students, they are not licensed, and that there is a large component of assessing what the plans of our educational institutions and our students are that is not included in this bill that we would like to also include, because obviously they are the future and soon-to-be practitioners.
And thank you for your leadership at AHEC.
Thank you.
The one question I would have, can we do it by rule? It's not mentioned in the draft. And that's with respect to determining the FTE full-time equivalency of a license. Because we see a lot of split practices. We see physicians are at point of their careers where they're practicing 2 days a week and beginning to fade out. Can we do that by rule, by virtue of this language?
Yeah, there is actually some standards in workforce surveys that identify full-time as a certain amount of hours per week or percentage of time. And the key is to make it consistent across the occupations. So we can do that within the rule.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments?
I have two questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this. It's something where you look at it and think, what a great idea. Why aren't we already doing this? I had a question about the health practitioners who do not have to be licensed, other than reflexologists. Who's out there who doesn't have to be licensed?
Well, actually, it's been quite. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's been quite interesting in terms of the study to be able to identify that we actually do have professionals who don't have to be licensed by particular boards. So let me give you some examples. Speech language pathologist
if they're working for the school districts, only have to be credentialed by the Teachers Practice and Standards Commission. There we have counselors who don't have to be, they call themselves counselors, or they're counseling as part of their occupation, that don't have to be licensed by the Professional Counselors and Marriage and Family Therapists Board. The Board of Psychology licenses those who practice psychology, but school psychologists don't have to be licensed by the board, but they do have to be have a certificate from the Teachers Standards and Practice Commission. Social workers don't have to be licensed to practice, but they do if they want to be reimbursed. Social workers can also be licensed as a counselor and family and marriage therapist, as well as psychologists could also be licensed under that. And then going back to anybody calling themselves a counselor don't have to be licensed. So we have several other examples like that, and I have a chart made out of each of those things I can share with you.
Thank you. And a follow-up, please, yes. Mr. Chair. Thank you. You have the participating boards listed on this report that you submitted, briefing report, but then in the bill there are only six boards listed. So how did you determine which six boards would be included, or better yet, which ones would be excluded?
We actually had quite a discussion on that. Mr. Chair. As part of the data collection effort, it doesn't mean that we won't collect or we won't ask them to share their database with us so we can look at the workforce. But by asking the additional questions identified in the LC and in the work plan, it will give us a good picture of what that particular workforce would look like. And the group also identified that to focus in on kind of the key access points to be able to access the healthcare system. And when we look at, let's say, for the nursing home administrators, there's only 142 skilled nursing facilities in the state that require a nursing home administrator to head them up. That the state has a policy of home and community-based care, and so there hasn't been any new skilled nursing facilities built for quite some time. So we know that that workforce isn't really going to change significantly, and it's so small. There's just 100, or just a little over 200 licensed nursing home administrators in the state, that we have a pretty good handle on that. If we look at the board of dietitians, there are other occupations doing similar work, such as nutritionists and nutrition counselors. So again, by asking these particular workforce questions, we're not giving the whole workforce, but we can still get the database.
Any other comments or questions?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, thank
you. Joe, as you indicated, Barney always does a great job of setting up, you know, workforce issues, which more than just, you know, the medical provider side of this equation, as we go forward, it's technical, vocational. This is a huge challenge facing this state, so we very much appreciate you being on point on this, as well as Patrick and Lisa, your attendance. If I could get you maybe just to shift gears just a little bit, or Mr. Chair, maybe you want to take 1435 at a different juncture, because I'd like you to get you to comment on the physician.
Well, those are really companion pieces. If you would like to go ahead and make comments on the LC 435. Or 1435.
1435. Tax credits to pay off.
Let's just move right along.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is Roy Brzezinski. Before we shift, should I ask another question or the clarification on 1163?
Yes. That would be very appropriate before we move on.
All right. I just was wanting to make certain, put on the record, first of all, in reading section 2, sub 5, which is on the bottom of page 2, that the regulatory board will, in fact, have the rule to have a determination as to what will or won't be disclosed in the sense of sensitive information regarding these individuals. I just want to make sure that's on the record.
a good point. Thank you.
The other thing is the conclusion of that LC, it has an emergency call. What I have not heard this morning, and I have not seen any documentation, is what is the anticipated cost for this so we can have that knowledge going into the session as to what it would cost to move this in and out of the 09 session on an emergency basis.
I think that's an excellent point and information that would be necessary to have as we go into session. So, Joe is nodding her head.
Yes, Senator. All right, thank you.
Okay, anything else? Okay, let's move to LC 1435, the tax credit for physicians.
Mr. Chair, with regards to LC 1435, the idea behind this is to create incentives to help move our practitioners out into underserved areas, into whether if it's geographically underserved or population underserved areas. This is the idea behind this tax credit is to help offset the cost of education, and it's a part. It's a tool to be included in the toolkit to be able to recruit practitioners to Oregon and to our underserved areas. So it's a little different than the other tax credit that Oregon currently has with regards to the rural practitioner tax credit. Some similarities, but the idea is targeting practitioners just out of school or those who have student loans to be able to offset some of that cost. And I've heard that, for example, new physicians, and Lisa can correct me if I'm wrong, are coming out of school with anywhere from $140,000 to $155,000 in student loan debt, and that's an average. It's average, but there are those who come out with a lot more. And to be able to offset and compete with those states around us as well as globally to get our practitioners out in the rural areas, this would be part of the tools to be able to help recruit. So I have provided a chart that kind of compares the proposed tax credit with the rural practitioner tax credit and the state student loan repayment program, which kind of compares the different policies. The student loan repayment program is actually it's from what I've heard, it's one of the first choice for recruiting practitioners to rural areas, but it doesn't serve those and it doesn't recruit to underserved population areas, and in addition it's limited in scope by legislative appropriations and certainly by the economy then, and so it isn't available to a larger number of people. The tax credit, the student loan tax credit for certain practitioners would actually be available to more practitioners or potential practitioners to be able to recruit them into those needed areas.
The language of the bill would address or help address the maldistribution in rural Oregon. I guess my question is, and it's a question I raised when we were in legislative counsel's office discussing this, is would it have an impact on physicians that make that decision early on over going into a specialty or subspecialty versus primary care, if they knew that they had this assistance and wished to practice in Oregon, would that have a positive impact on that path that physicians would take in their education?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it would. We have a variety of factors that influence our students' choice of careers. Medical students, for example, make that selection usually at about the end of their third year of medical school, apply for a residency in fourth year, and then spend 3 to 7 years in residency after completing medical school. So they're deciding very early on. At the same time, as most of them are fairly unsophisticated in managing debt and don't really yet have a lot of life experience in that area. And so things that we are able to demonstrate may help them pay off that debt adequately at that time when they're making those decisions in about their third year of medical school become increasingly important.
Thank you.
Chair Morrison, Chair Wesley, I had not seen this today, but before today, but I think I've heard about it. And I think it ties in very well. OHSU is starting a program, and it started at this past session, where they're taking students out into, I think there's five groups they've got right now, where they're going to be working out in the community with people from the faculty, which is something a little different. They basically just worked in a faculty clinic in Portland. They're going to be going out into other areas. And I think this is going to be a very good incentive for some of those people after they have a chance to go out and see some of these communities and work in these communities and say, hey, this might be a nice place where I'd like to live. Maybe I don't want to live in the Portland metro area or whatever the case may be, and now here's some financial incentive. I think anything that the legislature can do in regards to financial incentives for, and I'm just going to speak for dentistry right now, I think will have a very good impact upon the profession. And we hear this all the time. The board hears it when we go out, not just in board matters, that, you know, we can't get a dentist here, we can't, why are you preventing us from, it's not us preventing, there's not the incentive for the person. And I think this would be a step incentive. So this is the first chance I got to look at it just a few minutes ago, but I think it looks very good.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a comment. Dr. Dodson made a profoundly important comment, a little bit unrelated to what we're talking about today, but directly related to what we're talking about today. You know, when she said, here's this group of kind of the best and the brightest, you know, graduate medical students that have little life experience in managing debt and financial matters, which is understandable. I don't question your statement. But here's, like I say, some of our best and our brightest, and with little real exposure or understanding of money dynamics 101 and how money works. That's important. Anyway, thank you for making that comment.
Okay. Senator Przanski, comments?
No.
Okay.
Lloyd, we knew you were going to go to the what's the cost of the tax expenditure, but you know, I'll pretend I'm just channeling you, and that's yet to be determined.
There will be ample opportunity about this, both of these legislative drafts.
If you haven't seen the one I'm going to be putting together, it will be a little bit more expensive, but we have a good cause for the kids.
Well, we'll take that under due consideration.
Okay. I think, Reed, would you like to speak with respect to this issue? I know the governor's staff has a lot of interest in these issues, and we invite your comments.
Good morning, Chairman Morse, Chairman Westland, and other committee members. I'm Ree Sailors from the governor's office. I serve as one of his health policy advisors. I would just like to say that part of my job over the last year in particular has been following the Health Fund Board and its meetings and the sets of issues there, and also to look at health workforce and the HIT issues. And in the governor's preliminary development of ledge packages, both of these issues are of interest to us, and we would support this kind of legislation going forward, particularly as it supports the supply of primary care. As Barney alluded to in his Health Fund Board testimony, the idea of creating integrated health homes and disease management, particularly chronic diseases that are really the driver of utilization, has a lot to do with us having an adequate supply of primary care physicians, and also the integration of dental and oral and mental health is also important to us. So I think that the data collection piece is a starting point. I also think that with the data collection piece, as we go forward, it might also enable us to target some of these mechanisms, these tools like the tax credits, etc., more strategically, because we'll have better data to understand where we do have and where we don't have, and what types of shortages we're experiencing, so that we can sharpen our tools and make them even more effective. So I think this is both of these are two good sets of concepts that we really need to move forward on, and I thank you for bringing them forward.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ruth. Any comments further?
looking for some motions, Mr. Chair.
Got to go in the room.
Yes,
go ahead.
I don't know if somebody is on the record when I made that comment earlier. Last session, we did put a bill out that was a loan repayment plan that was broader than just in the healthcare area. And I do want to stress, I think this is an area for all of us to consider for Oregon, that there are a lot of economic depressed areas that need professionals. Clearly, healthcare is one of the top priorities. But there's other areas that we could also maybe extend this type of to keep the young and the bright and the newest graduates out of our higher education here in the state.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Close the informational hearing and open a work session of the subcommittee on healthcare reform for LC 1435 and LC
1163.
Explain the process first. Chair Westland has graciously afforded me the opportunity to vote. And the only way I could vote is if we move this from the subcommittee to the full committee. And so if we do that, then I step down and your committee can take it. But with that, we would entertain a motion from the subcommittee to the full committee.
As a member of the subcommittee, Mr. Chair, I move that LC 1163, dated 9-2608, be introduced to the full committee.
Senator Westland has moved that LC 1163, dated 9-2608, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
No, be moved to the Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor.
To the Interim Committee as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? Passed.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 1435, dated 9-2608, be introduced as a committee bill and be referred to the Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Senator Westland has moved that Legislative Council 1435, dated 9-2608, be introduced as a. Can you play it again? Anyway,
introduced to the committee.
Introduced to the Committee on Commerce and Labor as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Is there any objection? Motion passed.
Now close your.
So close the work session of the Interim Committee on Healthcare Reform.
Close your committee. Close your subcommittee.
I did.
Okay.
Oh, okay. We're closed.
And I will reconvene the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor. I will open up a work session on LC drafts 1163 and 1435, and I will accept a motion that they be introduced as committee bills.
Mr. Chair.
Man, I almost blew it. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that LC 1163 and LC 1435, both dated September 26, 2008, be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Bonamici has moved that LC 1163 and 1435, dated 9-2608, be introduced as committee bills to the full assembly. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Do we have any further business to come before us?
No, Mr. Chair. I guess we do need to announce that we're going to have one more hearing in early November to consider additional committee bills. The date is still out there, but it'll be early November. So as soon as we know, we'll get an agenda out to everybody. Thank you, Teresa.
Good bills, Mike.
Thank you.
Good work. Seeing no further business to come before the Senate Interim Committee on Labor and Commerce, we are adjourned.